everyone, and welcome to Film Strips, the podcast which sometimes happens to take a look at a film which combines the A-list acting caliber of Hollywood and 90s sitcoms. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir, but as the moon gets higher overhead, I may no longer be. Dave, who are we and what are we doing with everybody's time this episode?
Why, this is Film Strips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. The important thing is that each and every film must somehow connect back to the film we discussed upon the preceding week. Except for that bonus series, which we've now bracketed off and is done for now. We may return to it later on, where we take a look at a bunch of disconnected straight-to-video movies. But the important thing is, last week we returned to our regular schedule. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at on that episode of the show?
Last time we were looking at the Sisyphean task of screenwriting. We were looking at Mike Nichols' 1970 film Catch-22, a film that young Andrew really enjoyed, mid-tier Andrew also really enjoyed, but for some reason lately is less and less enjoyable every time. Maybe you can never go back. Maybe innocence is lost once... Once that youth is gone. Remember that. It'll be an extended metaphor. More importantly, it was directed by Mike Nichols, who we have decided to follow. What are we thinking? Maybe one of his famous ones? Nope. Instead, we decided to go to 1994 for a little film called Wolf. You may know it as the one with Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer on the poster and the moon between them. But we've got, as you noted, a who's who, and not just of who's that. We've got a cast consisting of Jack Nicholson, Michelle Pfeiffer, James Spader, Kate Nelligan, Christopher Plummer, sorely missed, Richard Jenkins, David Hyde Pierce, Ron Rifkin, Om Puri, David Schwimmer, like, and there's probably going to be like seven other people that we recognize. Yeah.
Yep.
Where to begin with this one? Because on the one hand, you would think a director like Mike Nichols, certainly as his career went on, maybe was less well-received. But there was certainly a time, as we got into last episode, certainly on the heels of The Graduate, Catch-22, his baffling improvisational comedy career alongside Elaine May. He's had a lot of significant films, but a lot of them seem relegated to the past. Even without having seen every Mike Nichols film, though, I would not expect him to make this one.
Well, particularly given that this is coming out right around the same time as The Birdcage, probably the last mega film that he did that most people will recognize. Maybe closer, but we'll get save that for another time. But yeah, you don't typically think genre piece and Mike Nichols, and there's a reason for that. But the thing is that it's in the context of the times, as we'll get into shortly after the break, this one will make a little bit more sense as to generally where it comes from, if not exactly explain the end results of what we get.
Well, yeah, but before we started talking, we were trying to figure out how much this film made back at the box office, and it ended up grossing around $130 million. It's got Jack Nicholson, who is arguably one of the most famous actors of all time, and yet I would bet you $5 if we walked into a room full of people and we asked them if they had seen Wolf, more would say they hadn't than had. And so I guess all of this is an elaborate setup to let Dave do what he does best, and that is give us the rundown.
Wolf is the 1994 horror drama from director Mike Nichols. Starring Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer, the film tells the tale of middle-aged New York publisher Will Randall, whose career seems to be coming to an early end thanks to a new corporate owner. Following a bite from a wolf, however, Will finds himself energized and ready to fight for what he wants, though it may come at a cost. Originally met with mixed critical reception, Wolf did end up proving to be a modest box office success, despite a high budget. Coming up after Film Strips, Jeopardy gets metaphysical as Grant Morrison guest hosts.
So, as we'll get into after the opening meta segment, this film comes from a very specific desire for it to be made. But I think before that, as you were mentioning, If we think about the context of the early 1990s film market, there's a couple threads you can pull on that sort of explain why this film comes out and why it is what it is a little bit better. And I think it's funny because we may be able to identify different strains leading to this inexplicable film. So, Dave, what's going on in early 1990s American cinema that would give rise to a creature such as this?
So the big context we want to think about is coming out of the 1980s. I think a lot of us will recognize that the 1980s was huge for horror, filmmaking in general, as far as Hollywood studios are
Was it?
concerned.
Give me some names.
Okay, so we got things like a little A Nightmare on Elm Street, that was ruling for New Line Cinema and basically made the studio. You had your Jason Voorhees killing a lot of teenagers in the Friday the 13th films 1 through 8 during that time. Sadly, despite the title, Jason did not take Manhattan.
No, but the Muppets did, so score one for them.
It
Power of teamwork.
indeed. But maybe if Jason had tried getting into the publishing industry, who knows? But putting that aside here, I mean, the basic thing is, though, is when we start noting a lot of these titles, let's be clear, horror has not been respected within the mainstream studio system ever, basically, with rare exceptions. It's one of those things where, particularly during this time, studios will tolerate horror films because they make money. But most of the majors weren't necessarily big on them. However, every so often, you have a major filmmaker take a stab at doing one of, a big mainstream horror film. So you end up with things like William Friedkin doing The Exorcist in the 1970s, which was a massive hit. You have John Badham doing Dracula in the late 1970s, as we looked at previously on the show, with Frank Langella as the Count himself. And that's the sort
You
of.
also got John Boorman doing The Exorcist 2,
Which the lesson.
featuring the Synchronizer.
Oh God, the synchronizer, yeah. But the big thing is that, basically because of the success of horror in the 80s, the studios were generally looking throughout the 1980s for ways to revive classic, sort of iconic IP, as we would to use the godforsaken parlance of our times, here, and sort of revive them, to make them fresh for a new generation. And this has led to some sort of auteurs getting into the genre. So we certainly had David Cronenberg taking his big stab with the Fly remake in the 1980s. But even then, this is before Cronenberg really had become, I would say, the household beloved auteur of.
Yeah, Cronenberg is an atypical example of most film trends, only because like he's one of the few guys to go from like very codified sci-fi, almost B-movie genre territory to becoming a radically different kind of filmmaker in terms of form and in reception. Like, it's
Exactly.
hard to watch a film like Rabbit and be like, well, this guy made Eastern Promises, all right.
Exactly. However, one of the big things is in 1992, we see a sudden shift. And this actually, Andrew, brings us back to the very first episode of this show we ever did in a little film called One from the Heart. Because if you remember that conversation, that was the movie where Francis Ford Coppola irresponsibly managed to run his own studio into the ground, on its
Yeah, but the
very.
parties were nice, I bet.
Indeed. But the key thing is, because of the failure of that film, for Coppola would spend the next decade or so pretty much doing, projects for the paycheck in order to pay off his expenses and rebuild his career in certain ways, and at least his financial foundation, which is why we ended up with things like The Godfather Part 3. However, the big one for our purposes that was part of that streak was a little film he did for Columbia Pictures called Bram Stoker's Dracula, aka, yes, the.
Before everybody loved Keanu and the one with Gary Oldman's hair.
Exactly. Which, if you've seen that film, A, it holds up. It is mag-freaking-nificent, folks. Highly recommend you check that one out there. But it kicked off what would I would say is maybe the prototype for what we would say is the prestige horror film. Because if you say that now, we're talking more about the art house, quote unquote, elevated horror. I hate that term with a passion. But I mean, of things such as Hereditary, your Midsummers, your St. Maud's, like the sort of very...
Well, even aside from like very notable ones, there's definitely a style that you see like more independent productions having. Something like It Follows,
yeah.
where it is a horror movie and like it's built around a gimmick that could very easily be like 80s drive-in type fare. But there is a very distinct approach in rendering the horror, and that sort of, that I think is what we really see flourishing in the 90s. Because you got to remember, aside from how popular films like Nightmare on Elm Street or the Friday the 13th were, most people were looking to them as artistic fare. And I think another part is, though, tying in with, Coppola sort of working for the paycheck, but that turn towards making horror respectable, I think part of that process is also a sort of hybridizing, much like Man and Wolf.
Well, and this is the thing. I would say the big distinction, yeah, between what we see as elevated horror now and what was going on in the 90s is that the people making the horror films now in that supposed prestige format, they legitimately seem to really come at horror as fans and come into it. Like, this is something they want to make, and this is how a lot of these filmmakers are building their careers. The 90s approach, however, was, well, what if we just take A-list talent and just throw it at a wall and see what sticks here? Which is why, okay, in Ford Coppola's case, this worked out. But let's throw out some other titles for you here, Andrew. Let's see how this goes. Because we would then get Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein in 1994, the same year as Wolf here. And, you know, Kenneth Branagh, this is, you know, pre-Thor and Jack Ryan shadow recruit Kenneth Branagh. This is him coming off of doing things like, you know, Hamlet and other, you know, this was the Shakespearean Kenneth Branagh in this instance here.
Yeah, very much capital A actor and capital D director.
Yes, exactly.
This was, 15 years before he discovered how to make a film that people enjoyed.
I think that's a little...
James, don't tweet me. Yeah, and then the film that I genuinely forgot about until you had mentioned it, Mary Riley.
Yes, Stephen Frears, Mary Riley, a.k.a. the Dr. Jekyll and Hyde film, which was, again, told about a maid who happens to fall in love with Dr. Henry Jekyll, and which included, you know, the perfectly nuanced, you know, romantic pairing of Julia Roberts and John Malkovich.
It makes about as much sense as Julia Roberts and Lyle Lovett. He's loving it.
The big thing is that there's a reason most of the films after Bram Stoker's Dracula tend to get forgotten, and it's, you know, and it's not to say that these are bad movies necessarily, but they are tend to be uneven ones. Like Branagh's Frankenstein, it's a noble effort, but I don't think it's going to be anybody's go-to Frankenstein one, despite, you know, Robert De Niro acting his heart out as the monster, which again, right there, Robert De Niro at the height of his powers in the early 1990s. You know, this is Goodfellas, you know, Robert De Niro. This is Cape Fear, Robert De Niro, you know. And then he goes and does...
Do you know that to prep for the role, he actually was a dead body for 3 months?
I am not surprised by his kind of dedication to that. But that's the thing. Like, this was really, you know, we got A-list screenwriters, we've got A-list directors, we've got the best talent, and we're using classic properties and monsters here to do it. Now, notably, none of these were necessarily Universal productions. Like, Ford Coppola did, again, Dracula for Columbia Pictures. I want to say the same thing with Frankenstein. I think that was a Columbia Pictures effort. Mary Riley, I believe, also. None of these were Universal. Universal was having its own hard time reviving the sort of iconography that they had. It wouldn't be until Brendan Fraser in The Mummy cracked the code in 1999 by going in a totally different direction.
Dave, may I?
Yes.
I really stopped paying attention for a moment there because I discovered something.
Yeah.
I was looking up 1990s horror films and I came across Embrace of the Vampire with Alyssa Milano.
Yeah.
And I was trying to remember who played the vampire because he was sort of weird looking. Turns out it's Martin Kemp. And do you know what Martin Kemp is most famous for?
Not offhand.
He was the bass player for Spandau Ballet.
Wow.
And other things you learn in addition to David telling us about every 1990s horror film ever made.
Point being here, that awesome fact aside, not sure if that translates well on screen, is the fact here that when it comes down to this, most of these films were not working. But then again, this brings us to Wolf, which, man, okay, this project, its origins sort of precede this wave,
Yeah,
but.
and it's sort of like the project, from all accounts that I've been able to find, this is something that was sort of almost a passion project in a way, because Nicholson, along with friend and writer Jim Harrison, they had been trying for the better part of a dozen years to make some form of what becomes this film. Now, everybody, I'm assuming, knows who Jack Nicholson is. Jim Harrison, though, is a more interesting cat because he is more famous as a poet, a published author, an essayist. More famously, even, he wrote the source material for Legends of the Fall. And as we'll soon see, there's a reason why he doesn't really work in Hollywood much longer than this. But yeah, by the 1990s, how many Oscars has Nicholson won? He can very easily write his own ticket. See the two Jakes. But him and Harrison, like, the time is right. They finally had the means to bring this project to life. And, I think it's funny because it often starts with a writer and a director, like we saw Buck Henry and Mike Nichols doing with Catch-22. In this case, though, Mike Nichols enters the project because Jack Nicholson decided that he would be a good guy to direct it. Apparently, this is the fourth movie that they had done together at that point. But, certainly seems like you're off to a good start, doesn't it?
Well, and this is where things get weird. So first of all, Mike Nichols, his career had had its ups and downs since the last time we talked about it. I mean, we got critically acclaimed films like Silkwood, there, which are a huge sort of critical smash, and I believe that was a box office success as well. And like I said, The Birdcage, which is probably, I think, probably the last iconic Mike Nichols film for many people. But let's not also forget, this is somebody who would go on and do things like Regarding Henry, which I remember as being a, somewhat critically respected. I don't think anybody
I
remembers
remember
it.
grown-ups that I knew liked it, and I didn't realize what it was about until many years later, and I'm like, wow, that is not what I thought. I always mix up Regarding Henry and Guarding Tess.
Oh yeah, no, those two very
But
different
there's no
films.
mistaking Boxing Helena.
Yeah, there is no mistaking that one. And I mean, of course, Nichols after this point would go on to do things like What Planet Are You From? The Gary Shandling
Oh
film.
God, that one,
Yeah,
yeah.
Charlie Wilson's War, which again, does anybody remember that one?
I saw it in theater. I learned a lot about how selling arms to the Mujahideen is great for freedom.
Sure it is. But yeah, I mean, Nichols, I mean, he comes on as one. He is still, as far as Hollywood's concerned, he's an A-list director. He's a respected director. And I mean, but he's also, as we sort of note here, he's not somebody who's done genre fare prior to this. Not really. And that's going to be kind of important as we go through certain segments of this movie. But my sense is that once he's on the project, there's a lot of infighting that starts basically happening, including.
Yeah, and it sort of depends on who you ask in terms of being able to source and verify what actually did go down. But there are a couple things that we know for sure.
Yeah. Ultimately, Harrison walks away or was fired from the project. A little hard to pin down on that one. And he had worked on, he had worked on a couple films preceding this, including Tony Scott's Revenge, that Kevin Costner one from, I believe, 1990 was when that it was released. But he's ultimately replaced by Wesley Strict. Now, Wesley Strict had worked on things like True Believer, the 1991 Cape Fear, and then everybody's favorite 1997 punching bag, The Saints.
Hehehehe.
So
cold fusion for the win.
Indeed.
And apparently Elaine May ended up doing uncredited rewrites, which is one of those things where it's like, you know, William Goldman is one of those cats where it's like, why is it, though, if you're uncredited, everybody knows about it? And the wiki bio also indicates that you did uncredited work. At what point is being uncredited credited?
Well, I mean, not to go down the rabbit hole of that too much, but I mean, part of it is a combination of people talking after the fact. Part of it is because these things get decided by the Writers Guild, so all...
Dave, I wasn't totally serious about exploring that.
Fair enough.
But yes. So yeah, so, and... You know, certainly Harrison's anecdotes indicated that there were a number of junctures where the script became a source of argument. Some have said that the entire third act of the film ended up being reshot at the studio's direction. Nicholson himself says only a couple shots and scenes in the climax were reshot. Apparently there was a different ending that audiences hated, but others say that no, we went with the ending that was on paper. It's one of those kinds of films.
Yeah, and needless to say, when the film ultimately comes out, it is a box office success, broadly speaking. Like, 131 against a reported $70 million budget. Now, keep that in mind, folks. That mostly had to go into securing the paychecks for the major players in this film there, because I cannot foresee another reason why that would be the case, unless shooting in New York was really just that expensive.
Apparently it was largely shot on soundstage, but I don't know. There's a lot of outdoors.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, I mean, particularly if that the one set is... You know, if that is indeed a set, then that's a hell of an elaborate set in terms of the publishing house that this is set in.
Money well spent there.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much elsewhere. But, yeah, like, it more than makes its money back. But, you know, critically, it's fairly mixed. Nobody really trashes it, but nobody really holds it up. And, I mean, its enduring reputation is fairly minimal. And I think maybe the answer for that is that after the fact, it's not clear that everybody was on the same page of what this movie is and what it's even supposed to be. Nichols says that it's a parable about civilization, AIDS, and the absence of faith, which, I mean, file under Streets of Fire, where it's like, your movie can't be about everything.
Yeah.
Composer Ennio Morricone, who we probably should have mentioned, said that he wrote it with the idea of a man who's trapped in a dream, and depending on how much you believe about the changes to the film's third act, seems that the studio wanted a monster movie.
Which seems baffling when you have these people involved here. I mean, like, you know, it's great that Jack's here, but what if, and just hear me out, he's Michael Myers, folks.
Yeah. But it's even more baffling when you realize that most of the first hour and 45 minutes of this film, they really don't seem all that different from another popular 90s trend, most starring Michael Douglas, the sort of male panic kind of film. And I think it's just a testament to the fact that no one making this film knew what they wanted it to be, and watching the film itself, it's hard to get a sense of what this film is trying to be. As I put it to you, this is James L. Brooks' movie with Rick Baker makeup. And I guess on that note, we should probably do what we always forget to do, and that's dive into the film itself. Because we begin fairly inauspiciously. We are following the one and only Jack Nicholson, who I think maybe for the first time is codified as supposed to be an old man. Here he plays Will Randall. We don't know much about him, but we do know that he's driving in Vermont late at night when something runs in front of the road.
Well, yeah, let's take a look at a few aspects of this, because ultimately what it's going to turn out to be is a wolf. He sort of hits one, and then he gets out to check on things and ends up seeing sort of a pack surrounding him here. Now, a couple things that'll become apparent right off the bat. The first thing is, as you're watching these opening scenes, it seems that Nichols is trying to very much evoke sort of classic Universal era horror films of the 30s and 40s, because that looks like a deliberately rear screen projection effect being used while Nicholson's driving, to give it, which, you know, with fairness, you know, again, Ford Coppola did something similar with his Dracula, where he used a variety of different effects work sort of throughout the history of cinema, all throughout that one. A lot of in-camera trickery, a lot of old school stuff that was just out of practice by the time he made that film. And I see what Nichols is trying to do. He's trying to sort of, you know, line this up in the sort of pantheon with those early movies and with stuff like Val Lewton's work on Cat People, which I had a number of moments where I was, my mind was drawn to that one. But then very quickly, once we see Jack Nicholson out with the with the wolves on the ground, we start to see that maybe Mike Nichols wasn't really used to working with special effects, because holy
crap. Oh my god, that animatronic.
Yeah, that puppet is
so
obvious.
Yeah, because we also get, like, you know, it's sort of undercut, you know, the nod to classic horror, and indeed even the setup of a lonely road in the middle of nowhere and something paranormal happens. It's kind of undone, though, because as Will gets out to check on the wolf, we end up getting close-ups of the wolf, like, opening its eyes and then closing them, because yeah. I guess wolves can lull you into a false sense of security.
I mean, the intent may have been it's almost hypnotic, but if that's what they were gunning for, this misses the mark when the audience is too busy laughing. It's like, really? I know.
But you know, it doesn't miss the mark. The wolf's jaws, which bites Will on the hand.
Yes, here. And the pack takes off. Will drives away, you know, injured, but still doing, you know, but he's still able to move about. It's not like he's, you know, seriously been bludgeoned to death in something like An American Werewolf in London. It's not that kind of film yet. But he drives off, and then we slowly get a sense of his day-to-day life. I can't remember whether we start at the publishing.
Well, that's the weirdest thing, though, because without knowing anything about our main character, from the way this film opens, would you then assume that he is going to be a fairly affluent editor-in-chief at a publishing house in downtown New York?
Well, no. And that, I mean, and I will say this, as a sort of sudden shift, it is a bit of a surprise if you're not coming in expecting that here. And I will say that can hypothetically work. But it all of a sudden feels, in this instance, that we're in a radically different movie than the one we preceded. And the thing is, at a certain point, you can almost forget that we're watching a werewolf movie because of how much...
Now, Dave, the film also never uses the word werewolf. They talk about wolves, they talk about demon wolves, but the film notably never uses the term werewolf.
Yes, yes. And George Romero never used the term zombie. Guess what, folks? I don't care. But yeah, I mean, this is the thing. So we introduced to him mostly to sort of key components. So first of all, he's married to his wife in this place, played by Kate Nelligan, which is Charlotte Randall. They seem to be sort of a happy couple as we're sort of introduced to them. You know, very middle-aged, just sort of that's like, oh, how was your night? Well, you know, anything go on, any plans, the usual sort of shtick. And when we get into the office, we discover there are a few key details that are going. First of all, he has a couple very loyal employees in this instance. One played by David High Pierce, simply known as Roy. And I believe it's Eileen.
I love Roy.
Yeah, he is. Like, David High Pierce is just a delight in this movie, because he's sort of like the... He's like a puppy dog. He is just like, yep, I'm loyal. I'm with you 100%. And I believe it's Eileen Atkins who's playing Mary, his secretary or assistant in this instance.
The one who knows him best, that sort of role. But she is good in it. It's not a sizable part, but she has some good lines.
Yeah.
We also soon meet his, not just his assistant, but his protege, played by James Spader.
Yep.
He looks so young here. Stuart Swinton, one of those great alliterative villain names. But we also learned that there's a big goings on in the publishing house, because they've just been bought out by, I guess, a syndicate of some kind, owned by the tycoon Raymond Alden, played by Canada's own and dearly departed Christopher Plummer.
Yes, and...
So word is, there's cuts to be made, and, you know, Nobody really reads poetry anymore. Publishing is a tough market. I don't know if Will's job as the EIC is necessarily secure, and certainly Will recognizes that he's probably going to get fired.
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, certainly it's in keeping with the era and time as well, because the 70s, 80s, into the 90s, this is the era of the sort of mega conglomerates really coming to the forefront, with things like, Time Warner coming into existence, and all of a sudden, there's a publishing division, there's the film studio, there's all these things. Again, publishing, yes, it's presented here, it's getting absorbed into something larger. And, basically what we're seeing with Roy and Mary is that they're promising to stay loyal to Will in this instance, and that they'll go with him if he gets shown the door. To which his whole response is like, look, don't do something that you're gonna regret here. It's like, it's nice of you doing it, but we're not at that stage. And he seems fairly mellow about it, even when he goes to see his protege in the form of James Spader here, who's struggling with an author who's He's trying to sort of sweet talk into things here, because she feels she's not getting a fair shake of things here, which
Well, yeah. The whole thing with Will is that maybe he's old, maybe he's a product of a bygone era, but by God, the writers love him. He knows what he's doing. And I mean, it is a bit more subtle in terms of, noticing changing trends in media and society than, say, Cameron Crowe's Vanilla Sky, which is, I was just thinking, this is a lot more preferable to Timothy Spall writing Cameron Crowe's speech about why books are important.
But the big thing here is that, we've got to his face, we got Swinton basically telling Will, it's like, look, we've got the big soiree tonight there. I've already talked to him, it's or to Alden, and it's like, I'm really rooting for you to keep here. That and again, Will just sort of seems, I don't want to say resigned, but it's almost like, well, I know
He's
the
sort of in about Schmidt mode, like 15 years too soon, where it's just, yep,
That's
okay.
exactly. Like, he's just sort of, it's like, it's gonna come. I'm not gonna like it, but I know it's coming.
He's taking it with dignity, because that's what a real man does. But yeah, so I guess the plan is to have a big party at the Alden estate, and they're gonna find out what the future holds. And the whole time, it becomes very easy to forget that the film opened with Jack Nicholson being bit by a wolf.
Exactly. Then again, maybe the animatronic is still stuck in your head there, folks. So just keep that in mind. It'll become important soon. But the key thing is that, him with his wife, they head to the party there, and
We
ultimately.
get a small cameo from a young Allison Janney.
Yep.
But eventually, the moment of truth comes. And Will is invited for cigars and a conversation with Raymond himself. And I gotta say, Christopher Plummer as Raymond is pretty great casting, because Christopher Plummer is just so good at playing a character that alternates between kindness and malevolence very effortlessly. And it's better displayed here than, God, what was it? All the Money in the World, where he played J. Paul Getty. That film's so good that everybody forgot about it, including me, by the end of the episode where we talked about it.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, because the way his Alden's play, it's not like he's the overtly cruel individual. It's like, I'm just gonna gut and slash everything here. He's basically talking Will through. It's like, I was hoping you'd be willing to take this position over, and I think it's India they say that they want him to,
Europe,
or just in Europe.
Eastern Europe, looking to expand. You're a good man for the task, and I think you can do it. But I like how there's sort of that understanding between them, where Will responds with, so basically, take no job or take a job that nobody wants.
And that's the big thing. And again, the way Plummer plays it, it's like he knows that Will understands that, but he never basically, comes out. It's like, ah, you figured out my ploy or anything. It's like, yeah, you figured it out. And that's basically the way the cookie crumbles in this instance. But it
It's
gets.
like, sorry. Well, the other piece is that part of the rationale for letting Will go is, he's a. What is it? He's unique, Or what's the line that they keep calling back to? Something and individualistic.
Yeah, and that's the big thing. I mean, he does seem to stand on his own, and he has his opinions. He is a forceful man, which, again, as played by.
But at the same time, they seem to also be implying that Will is too nice, and Raymond is looking for somebody, well, as he puts it, somebody with ambition, somebody who definitely has his sights on the top.
Yes.
And we very quickly learn who that person is, and that's Stewart.
Yeah, I mean, if the casting of James Spader alone didn't tip you off right from the get-go in this one here,
Yeah,
folks.
he's very good at being disingenuous.
Yeah.
Because sure enough, they get back inside, and it's the, oh my God, I can't believe Raymond did that. I mean, we had discussed it, but do you want me to turn down this job? I will. Say the word. I will.
Exactly.
Now, is this before or after, though, Will also scares the horses?
I think it's around this point that he wanders off and or no, because he I think this is after because he has the conversation with the cigar. They spot the horses far away when he's talking with Alden there. And then they start getting spooked by him, and he has a bit of what ultimately will turn out to be a bit of a panic attack, it seems like, at the moment. And
Yeah.
this is where
Because then he disappears, and then a mysterious figure in like a motorcycle jacket hands him a glass of scotch, and then we see who that someone is in the form of Laura.
yes.
Laura Alden, mind you, played here by Michelle Pfeiffer, going from Catwoman to Wolfman.
Yes. And number one, like I said, I mean, her big thing is she's taking a look and taking care of this guy, and it's very clear very quickly that they're between the banter they have, she's not necessarily her father's biggest fan. It's not that she hates him, but she kind of recognizes the kind of crowd he runs in, the kind of dealings he does, and that's just not for her. He's a very controlling individual, and she is very independent-minded about a lot of things.
Yeah. Apparently, one version of the script, they really wanted to make her, like, just in case no one was getting it, an animal rights activist. That was vetoed. I don't think it's terribly clear what she does other than knows how to handle herself in the real world.
Yeah, exactly. But her and Will sort of hit it off. They have, he's just sort of charmingly saying, it's like, well, it's kind of a crappy night, but without being, in a charming way where he admits, yeah, things have gone wrong for him, but that's life. And they sort of part on fairly decent terms. And this is, yeah, when he goes and finally runs into finding out about Swinton, the whole disingenuous thing, and then ultimately him and his wife leaving the party with her talking about it's like, oh, they shouldn't have done that, and particular to you there, Will, and going on and on, and particularly,
Doth protesting too much, as they say.
yeah, and that's going to be important later on. But sure enough, as the night carries on, Will continues to feel a little different there, a little odd. And let's not forget that, there was an earlier scene where I think preceding this, him and his wife had what's clearly implied to be a romantic night of coitus as well, preceding us. The important thing is that, okay, it seems like things are going to be fine. Well, not fine, but I mean, he seems to have accepted his fate. But things quickly escalate in a few different ways, don't they?
Well, yeah, first off, he sleeps 12 hours with what feels like a very, very old kind of gag there, whereas he said, let me sleep till 8. It's 8 p.m. But we also see he's growing hair from his palms, maybe related to that night of coitus. And in the office, though, Jack Nicholson suddenly discovers that he has superhuman hearing and senses.
Yeah, because he basically we have thing a number of discussions he overhears and then telling people over the phone about this, or being able to smell the booze that's in one guy's coffee.
Well, the drop of tequila in his coffee, and I'm like, it's been nearly 7 years since I've enjoyed it, but I cannot for the life of me imagine the words enjoy and tequila coffee coming together. But that's also Canada for you. All that to say is he starts recognizing something as strange is going on. So what do you do? You Get somebody to look up a dignified and serious authority on the case of animal possession.
Well, even before that, he does go to see his doctor, Ron
Ron
Rifkin.
Rifkin.
Yeah, which is basically, it's just like, it's like there's nothing weird here. Things are fine. Just get some rest and keep going with it. But yeah, he does ultimately put his employees to work on figuring this out. And eventually he will get a name from that. But we'll come back to them because when he gets home, his wife had told him that she's going out of town for work purposes here. But he suddenly notices when sniffing somebody, he starts sniffing her clothes when he gets home. And it's like
My man.
something a little odd is going on. And we just sort of see him like he's wandering the streets of New York, almost sniffing around until he ultimately ends up at the home or at the apartment of Swinton
Stewart.
here, where he opens the door. There's what, Robert, what are you doing here? And then in the background, there is Will's wife.
Robert, his name is Will.
Yeah, Will. Yeah, sorry.
But yeah, we also get that maybe the first shot though that really kind of disrupts its own diegesis, which is Jack Nicholson, an old man, bounding up the stairs like as if guided by wire as well. But he rushes to the top and the bedroom door opens and there's Charlotte caught in the act. He also bites Stuart on the hand. Remember that 90 minutes later.
So the big thing is that, yep, that's a certainly a betrayal, and thus setting up for the possibility of the winter or spring summer or no is it
Fall
fall
winter.
winter romance that will follow between
Spring summer romance. He is 28, she is 27.
Yes, in this case it's more like 53 and Michelle Pfeiffer at like age I want to say what 30 at this point,
I
32.
don't know.
Point is, there's an age gap here, folks, and it's recognizable on screen, but we'll get to that. Point of the matter is here, this basically pushes Will into taking action and deciding, no, I'm going to stand my ground at this point.
Yeah. And now here, David,
Yeah.
I would say this could be any other 1980s, 1990s film about modern society. Like, this arc of the film would work totally fine even without any of the supernatural trappings.
Yeah.
Because, again, we see the idea of an antiquated man getting on in years, hitting bottom, and then reasserting himself. Like, that sort of old guy still got it, old ways are good ways kind of narrative. And, like, honestly, I think it would have worked fine as is. And maybe to your point that Nichols, he can do a lot of things, but he's not great with action scenes. I almost feel like this is the stronger part of the
Oh,
film.
by far. Like, this is the stuff where Mike Nichols is clearly engaged and knows what he's doing, and everybody seems to be on the same foot because it's basically just ultimately a power competition between a couple of men who are basically seeing who's going to get control of the situation. And we see Will get to work, basically getting Roy and Mary in on the gang of the gang of it's like, look, start calling up all our different authors, start telling them that I'm basically going to be leaving, I'm going to be starting my own publishing company, and that everything's going, oh good, we got partners in this. Absolutely not. But lie through your
Yeah.
teeth here. And sure.
Doesn't have to be true. That's just what you tell them. So he starts making his play because, again, maybe Raymond wants him out of the job, but the writers certainly want him around.
Exactly. And basically, we once again get another delightful scene with Swinton as he tries to fake apologize. It's like, I know I betrayed you, Will. I know everything's wrong, and I understand if you feel. I just love Nicholson. Like, just turns on a dime, and it's like, nope, not putting up with that BS anymore. It just, it's like basically starts out. It's like, yeah, you're gonna have to fight for this if you want it. And sure enough, he basically starts concocting this whole scenario where what his ultimate end goal isn't really to start off a separate publishing entity, it's to force Alden into basically re-signing him because he's gonna lose so much of basically the people, that they depend upon for their business.
Well, but I think more than anything, it's Moffat out of spite against Stewart and doing what he says, not taking it lying down. But and I mean, we'll certainly get there, but that arc more or less plays out fairly predictably. Whereas something that seems very predictable and plays out, I don't know how I would expect, but the ongoing relationship with Laura and the fact that they don't even really seem to get along all that well. He has that interesting little monologue about how that's the problem with you. You want men to love you and they love you because you're pretty. And, you know, again, it very much feels like her dad is talking to her.
Yeah.
But, against all odds, though, the two hit it off, and, you know, staying out at the Alden family estate, you know, that night is spent.
Well, yeah, and I will say this. There's enough chemistry between Pfeiffer and Nicholson to pull it off. I mean, if, you know, Catwoman and Joker had to get together in some form, I'm willing to go with it here. But, I mean, it's also, that age gap thing is so hard to overlook, though, because it is...
It's a bit weird, but that being said, though, I think part of why it kind of works, if it can be said to work, is the fact that they're both very headstrong people.
Yeah.
And you almost get the sense that through his ongoing relationship with Laura, Will is rediscovering that backbone because he has to start fighting for a change.
It is, but it's also tied in with this whole notion of the quote-unquote male power fantasy of, no, I'm still virile and, you know, sexually potent at the age of 50s, whatever.
Very much so. Yeah. And, you know, again, going back to Nichols and co. all having a different idea of what this film is symbolic of. It can certainly be said, though, that the wolf metaphor is symbolic of something.
Well, exactly. But things continue, while there's all these positive things that seem to be happening to Will, and ultimately, yes, he will get exactly what he wants from Alden, which ultimately turns out to be not only his job secure, but an increased pay, increased powers across the board for decision making, and yeah, basically the
power. And most importantly, he gets to fire Stewart.
Exactly.
Yeah, but betwixt all of this, though, after that first night with Laura, the moon is full, and Will's belly is empty because he turns into a werewolf, and then he goes running on the grounds, and then he eats a deer.
Yeah, and let's talk about the werewolf makeup here for things, because based on the animatronics that you saw at the start of the movie, you might sit there and think it's like, oh, he's going to become a full-on, like, he's a wolf in this instance. That's the regression.
He grows sideburns and teeth, and that's more or less it?
Yeah, it's like they took a look at the Wolfman design that Lon Chaney Jr. wore back in the Wolfman and said, what if we do that, but less? And, I mean, it kind of, I mean, I'll put it this way. It's preferable to probably putting Jack Nicholson under an elaborate prosthetic makeup effect in this instance.
Yeah. And, I mean, kudos to them because they got one of the most lupine-looking men in the world to play the role. It's, as you say, it's really more using the makeup to accentuate the features that are already there.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's just, yeah, the way in which, you know, Nichols is shooting, again, it's like he really was studying, like, again, those Lon Chaney werewolf films and seeing how, well, how, this is how Chaney moves. This is how they filmed it. And you see a similar thing here going on, which in things like when we all of a sudden wake up the next morning and it turns out he's ate a horse there. That's one thing. It kind of works there. Later on in the film, when it suddenly takes a veer into Central Park, less so. But
or him confronting a gang of hoodlums.
Yeah. It's,
yeah.
Yeah.
But so we have a couple transformational sequences, and you know, Will is sort of coming to grips with the monster inside, the manimal, as it were. But that coincides with you know, a nice little scene with Indian acting legend,
Om Puri.
Om
Yeah.
Puri, as Dr. Alizeus, the expert on animal possessions, who lives in a dingy little apartment, was just brewing tea, and just comes off as like the sweetest old man in the world. But we get the encounter between them at the apartment, where Will comes in, basically talks about his symptoms, and Dr. Alizea's character, he's not a mad scientist. He's
No.
not, you have been cursed by the mark of the beast or anything like that. It's almost like he, I think why it works, and like you said about the makeup, where it is kind of trying to ground it, and the way that he talks about, the transformation really seems more in line with like 1980s, 1990s self-help, new age mysticism.
Yeah.
And like here, you do get the clear sense, though, that they are using the wolf as a symbol, while it's also a literal transformation at the same time. But he talks about the history of the demon wolf, and don't let the name fool you, though, it can be a positive. If you transform into a wolf, you are not evil unless you're evil in the first place. Remember that.
Yeah. Well, and this is the thing. I like a lot of the details of the scene because you're right. I mean, as Puri plays him here, he is a very gentle figure. And I love the fact that, he's an expert, but it's not like he knows everything by his own admission. It's like, yeah, I'm not really. Yeah, it's like, I know stuff, but I mean, who can really be an expert in something like this? But
Exactly.
yeah, but what's really interesting is, and the detail I really love about the scene is he basically asks Will for a favor, which is like, look, it's fine, but will you bite me? And and his reason is because he's getting old, he's kind of dying at this point. He wants to have the benefits that come with this, and Will really isn't sure whether he should, and it's like, basically the kind of like, I can't do this in this thing. And again, it's that sense of it's like, well, am I doing something that's a benefit for him? Or is it, am I just going to make somebody else's life a living hell? But the important thing is that ultimately, I mean, I love that detail because it's very rare that you have, somebody's like, no, please, please turn me into a werewolf, here, number one.
Well, yeah, and Will, you almost think he'll be the "No, you madman." Instead, it's just Jack Nicholson sitting in a chair being, "Yeah, I just don't think so, pal."
Yeah.
And even more strangely, Dr. Alizeus is basically, "That's okay, I understand too. Here, have this magic amulet."
Yeah, the amulet thing, which again, I get it. You kind of there's a reason they need sort of a totem of some sort, in this film, which again, it's a genre trope, it's a staple. That's fine, but it feels, given how this film has handled so much of the material so far, it just feels a little weird in this
Well,
movie.
even in the scene itself, because it actually does straddle the nuance of it, like it's like Peter losing his powers in Spider-Man 2, where it's like, yeah, I mean this is about actual powers, but this is we're also talking about more than that, aren't we? And then it caps it off with, "By the way, this special necklace will keep you from becoming a wolfman."
Well, exactly. And I always, the thing that always throws me about these totems is it's like, where do they come from? Like, I mean, because you get the sense of, it's like, did you make this? Did you find this? If you made it, can you mass manufacture them? Because that would probably be a useful thing for a lot of people. Because presumably that's a lot of wolves that are hanging out in the Vermont area, based on what we're seeing in this movie. But the key thing is, yeah, he Will walks away. He's got that, the amulet here, which is supposed to help keep things in check. But things keep escalating because, first of all, Will sees his wife again, and she's basically coming to him sort of apologetic, like, I know it was wrong. I know I shouldn't have betrayed you. Can we work this out? And Will basically is like, nope. I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, because she throws in the thing with Stewart, it was nothing. He never meant anything. And we get ice cold Nicholson being like, "Oh, so you betrayed me for nothing?" And
Yeah. Yeah. It's a well-written scene. She wanders off sort of despondent. But the important thing is that I think it's around this point that yes, we get the Will going about Central Park while in werewolf mode and in confronting the gang, which, oh my God, this, I mean.
Yeah, because first we see him in one of the animal enclosures, to which he's stopped by two policemen, including one played by a year before Friends, David Schwimmer,
Yep.
who draws his gun. Wolf Will escapes and steals a pair of handcuffs, Chekhov's handcuffs, which does lead to the funny beat of, "He took my handcuffs." But then shortly after, he's just like walking around, bipedal Wolfman style, when three very. I can just picture the script now saying either three hoodlums or three gangbangers approach Will.
Yeah.
And, I mean. Setting aside, race for an instance, there's just something fundamentally weird about three guys walking up to a man who is clearly a wolf man and asking him how much money he's got. And weirder still, Will, even though he's like turning into primal beast mode, is able to have a conversation with them and sass them.
Well, that's the thing, because the werewolf, the nature of the werewolf transformation gets a little wonky. Now, maybe this is caused by the amulet in this case. Maybe it's,
Well, because we saw at the beginning with the deer, like he has no recollection. Like he shifts into a different brain when he transforms. Whereas here, nope, he is very much Jack Nicholson right now.
Yeah, and he will wake up the next day and ultimately find that, yes, there are fingers in his pockets and that presumably from this gang in Central Park. But it's just it's number one.
Yeah, because he bites the dude's fingers off.
Yeah.
But it's the whole, "Well, I've got $1,000, punk. How much would you like? 10, 20? Let's ice this fool." And
Yeah. It
yeah, which again, it doesn't seem like it'll be super important because it's sort of washed aside. Because the next scenes are him more or less staring down Raymond in the boardroom, making his play and succeeding at it. And we get the begrudging respect. And again, Raymond announces that, well, he's more than happy to pay him because he's discovered how ruthless Will really can be. Now he's impressed.
Yeah.
And then we get the bathroom confrontation between Stuart and Will, which is a good scene. Because I think you also see that Spader does have that talent for knowing when to drop the mask as well.
Yeah.
Because at first he's all surprised, and then he finds out that Will snookered his job from under him, and then he's apologetic and the, "Please, just give me a few months.
Yeah.
You can say that I resigned my position," but Will absolutely refuses.
Yeah.
And then the mask comes off. We get some threats, and I can think of the. At least two movies now where Jack Nicholson has sort of capped off a scene by angrily and defiantly pissing all over a bathroom.
Yeah, and on to James Spader himself.
And as he says, "I'm marking my territory. You got in the way."
Exactly. It is. But I mean, yeah, Spader, I love what a Weasley individual Spader's able to play. Like he's just got that, and sort of manic energy just beneath the surface for these
Well,
things.
yeah. And the scenes are capped off where, in spite of the threats and everything, it ends with him walking over, using paper towel to dry off his leg, and then, like, almost petulantly being, "These are suede shoes."
Yeah, exactly. But the big thing is that what we'll very soon see is after another night of transformations, whoops, it
Well,
turns.
no, because he finds the fingers in his pocket, and then he starts realizing, oh, something is going on here.
Yeah, and then it turns out when the police arrive, in the form of, yes, Richard Jenkins as Detective Bridger, for the first time, I think, since Sea of Love, where he also played a detective,
Yeah.
in this instance. Again, he shows up, and it turns out that, whoops, it seems that Charlotte has been murdered in this
Well,
instance.
because this is after him and Laura shack up in the hotel that he's staying at.
Yeah.
And yeah, we also, I think this scene is also important though, because while Will's in the shower, Laura's the one who answers the door and realizes it's the police. And because again, like for all her devil may care attitude for the most part, and is this before Will handcuffs himself to the radiator or after?
I think this is before.
A lot happens in this movie, but she seems like almost drawn to Will because of an element of danger about him. But then the second that Jenkins shows up and announces he's a detective, there's very much a shift where it turns to suspicion and fear of Will. And as you say, they try to play it for laughs. Will introduces himself, says that we must have made a lot of noise last night, and then tries to play off Laura being his fiancée. And he says, "And who might you be?" Richard Jenkins has that great, "I'm Detective So and So. Your wife has been murdered."
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it feels like Richard Jenkins is almost been like a recent discovery given his string of work over like the last 15 years. But my God, he has been great all along in these kinds of
Yeah, he is a very solid character actor, and it is a shame that most people of a younger age only know him as hysterically funny comedic actor in Step Brothers, but not exactly the most representative of what Jenkins can do, given that he looks like, close your eyes and picture Sad Sack. That's Richard Jenkins. But he's fairly decent here. But he basically questions about the whereabouts, wants to know the last time that Will saw his, well, I guess now ex-wife, and then basically tells him that, without forcing you to, we need you to come in and take a statement and give us some samples so we can compare it to the body. And that's sort of the moment where Laura really starts thinking that maybe if he's not transforming, at least there's a chance that he murdered his wife.
Exactly. And we see it's not helped by the fact that Will's panicking and now unsure whether he's been respon he is indeed responsible for these for the situation here, which
Yeah, and they agree to lay low in that, but there is that sort of effective scene when they're driving. And Will is sleeping in the passenger seat, and we just see Laura and a bunch of shots of her face looking at different things like the fingernails scratched up, the dirt on the bottom of his shoes and everything. And without any words being said, you can see the process of her believing, wait a sec, this all makes sense now. He's the killer.
And ultimately, I'm trying to remember exactly how this plays out now, because ultimately something does push her to finally go to see the police. Basically, with the conviction, it's like, yeah, I gotta report on Will, in this
No,
instance.
because they called the house, and with his superhuman hearing, Will knows the phone is ringing. Laura answers it. It's Detective Bridger, but he also indicates that there's been a bit of a problem with the samples from the body, because all of the swabs they took show distinctive traces of canine DNA, which means samples are useless because some dogs must have got to her afterwards.
So it's in this instance, Laura is starting to freak out. Will's talking about possibly being a werewolf and asking her to sort of, I believe it's at this point that he asks her to lock him up. He has the horse stables there, where apparently they just have a cage for some reason. I don't
Yeah,
work with
because they're
horses.
wealthy people, Dave. They have all sorts of things people don't need, especially with horses. Remember Mitt Romney?
Let's not go down this road right now. But I sit there and say, it's like, I don't handle horses. I don't know why a cage would be necessary. When you have the stables there, right there. That's all I'm saying. Point being that.
Because you need a place for the climactic fight scene. But yeah, while Will is sleeping off the last hair of the dog, Laura ends up going to the police station. We get your typical New York squad room waiting area, and like the Laura asks for Bridger. While she's waiting, though, she happens to encounter a familiar face to us. Though a bit less familiar, we encounter Stuart, and if it wasn't clear from his yellow contact lenses, literally everything about him from this point on in the film is 180 degrees different. And without it being explained to us, and without it dawning on you what's happening, like as to why, we very quickly realize, oh, he's a wolf man too.
And this is the thing. This is the moment where the film basically goes off the rails, because everything after this scene is just like, you all lost the plot and had no clue as to how to wrap this thing up because.
This scene comes from a different film. James Spader is playing a different character.
Yeah.
And you're right. The film becomes very different for the next, like, 20 minutes, half an hour.
Yeah, because basically Spader is acting like a complete lunatic supervillain at this point where everything.
Yeah, not even, like, animal-esque. He is an animal, right?
Yeah.
And it's just contrasted with, like, him suddenly speaking very gentlemanly, my dear. Oh, well, I'm pleased to make your acquaintance. I didn't realize you knew Will. While at the same time, he basically has half of the Rick Baker gear on, and he's, like, sniffing her and things like that, in case the people in the back row didn't get what's going on.
Yeah, and he's basically there to report on Will and explain everything. And he, again, I do like the scene where he's explaining the whole situation to the police there, and he's still doing his faux graciousness, and it's like, I didn't want to betray Will and all these things. I mean, I care
exactly.
for him.
And the whole, I heard him say he was going to kill his wife. I didn't think it was serious.
Yeah.
But this is clearly a crime of passion.
Yeah.
And if you arrest him, I will testify to that.
Exactly. But of course, you know, Laura quite wisely recognizing that, you know, this dude is either a crazy werewolf or a serial killer, you know, thus predicting, what was that? There was that film where I think James Spader played like Jack the Ripper in Modern Times. Was there not, or something like that?
There was The Watcher with Keanu
That's
Reeves.
That's the one I'm thinking
played
about.
Played a cop stopping him.
Oh, okay, maybe I'm just
I saw that in theater too.
Okay, maybe I'm getting something mixed up here. But the point is that, yeah, as soon as he, you know, Laura has taken off from the station during his interview with the police. But don't worry, you know, Swinton's going to follow her because he's going to follow his nose, much like Toucan Sam. But, I'm sorry, I apologize for that joke, folks. The key thing here is that she goes rushing back, now concerned and realizing that, yes, he's the real killer in this situation.
Yeah, and I think there's an offhand line about how there's a bunch of other murders, so I guess Stewart has been keeping busy since he got fired.
Yeah, I mean, it's so clear that they're trying to rush this revelation and work in also, like, there's no build-up, it's just, and boom! This has happened now. And lo and behold, this ultimately leads back to the Alden estate where Jack has gone full wolf form, or at least as full wolf form as he is.
Well, we get the slow transformation because the amulet is keeping the wolf at bay.
Yeah. And while this is going on, Laura shows up and starts dropping all the plot details. No, it was Swinton all along. And sure enough, you know, Swinton shows up basically in full wolf mode to threaten to kill her while Jack's locked up in a cage.
And like, he tries to, I guess, charm his way past security, which is kind of undone by the fact that he's wearing like a sweatsuit and he's clearly a wolf man.
Well, exactly. Like, yeah, it does not make any sense. Ultimately, he kills the guard.
He ends
anyway.
Up running down the one guard and then eviscerating the other one. But yeah, he plays the game of cat and mouse with Laura. And eventually, things come to a head in the stables where he sees his old rival caged up, whereas he gets to be the free, unrestrained animal. He taunts Will a little bit, and then right as he's about to pounce on Laura, Will does the noble thing. He tears the amulet away so he can transform into Super Saiyan Jack Nicholson werewolf.
And let me be clear, if it wasn't clear that Mike Nichols has no clue how to film effects, action sequences, or anything else along those lines.
It is rough going.
Oh, this is just, like, it is so clumsy in the execution. Like, camera angles don't make a lot of sense. It's very clear that the actors are the way in which they're like, they're the choreography could be brilliant, but at the speed it's being performed and the mannerisms and sort of over exaggerating, none of it works or connects in
well
this
it's
sense.
Not even terribly interesting. It's just a wolf fight. They're jumping way too high in the air.
Yeah,
and it's that weird, like, this is the one part where them going more all out with the makeup may have helped instead of these weird, like, hybrid James Spader and hybrid Nicholson things. And, like, the editing just seems a little bit off.
Yeah.
Like, because there's, you know, at one point, you know, Stewart advances and Will swings a pitchfork and it cuts to, like, an exact side-on shot. And it seems to wait a little bit too long, so it disrupts the fluidity of the action. It very much, like watching this climax, you can tell that this is a series of stationary shots, whereas good editing can give a sense of rhythm to something.
Well, and I mean, the thing is I mean, the editor on this film is Sam Osteen, who's one of Mike Nichols' regular collaborators. And again, the editing is really great up to this point, but this is exactly why I feel that, this.
Like conversations and boardroom scenes are edited well. The action scenes are not.
Exactly. And that's why I feel like this is just a case of the two of them. I mean, Nichols for sure, probably. I get because you look at his body of work, and I mean, honestly, probably the closest thing to a quote unquote action sequence he shot is probably some of the bomber runs in Catch 22. Like, this is
Yeah, and like that bomber run scene was really good,
it's
but it was also a lot of long take there, and there wasn't reliance on makeup effects.
well, on top of which, it's mostly the characters in the midst of being in the bomber, being terrified of what's going on. Like, the real action is happening outside where we're not seeing it there. And that works fine for that film. There's no similar get around when your entire approach is two dudes wolfing out and going at it with one another here. And yeah, it's so clumsy, it's so inept, and ultimately, the as you will not be surprised, Will ends up killing Swinton in this, and ultimately, takes
Well, no,
off.
Will doesn't kill Swinton. Swinton's about to pounce on him, and then we get a slow motion sequence of Laura using the dead guard's gun
Oh,
to kill
right.
Stuart. And even then, the problem is you get one gunshot, slow motion James Spader too high in the air going, "Urgh!" Cut back to Laura, another gunshot. Cut back to James Spader again going, "Urgh!" And he like groans from being shot, like three out of the five bullets. But because it's done shot reverse shot, like it makes it sound like he's doing it anew every time.
Well, I almost get like for some reason, I mean, this it's a little bit like remember Prizzy's Honor, the final,
Oh
gun
my
versus
God,
knife.
yes.
Like, literally with Jack Nicholson, climactic battles seem to be a real thing that he struggles with in the movies we've watched so far.
Except for Batman 89,
Okay,
that
that's
one still
Oh
works.
God, yeah. But yeah, I mean, yeah, this is just it's just clumsy, but yeah, she kills Swinton. And ultimately, I can't remember whether she encourages Will to run off into the
Well, they sort of
countryside.
have that tender embrace, and then, yeah, Will runs off into the New York wilderness with the only thing left to answer some questions. So Laura comes out of the house, the police and her father are there, and I don't even remember this part because I sort of checked out. But there's a couple key takeaways, though, which is Laura indicates that Will is gone, he's not here. But she also happens to be able to smell the vodka tonic that Detective Bridger had consumed earlier in the evening. Is this symbolic, Dave?
Well, all I'm just going to say is there will be a nice little wolf pack probably coming in the near future for the never to exist sequel, Wolf 2.
Well, yeah, and then the final shots are Laura like walking towards the camera. Big fly over to the middle of the woods, and we see yellow eyes and a howl, and then that weird zoom reverse back to Laura, and then a close up on her eye as it starts turning yellow.
Yeah, it's just like, again, as if you missed the point here, folks. We got it, Mike. We got it.
Well, but that's the thing, because if you look this movie up on the internet, it doesn't actually help anything, because most people's takeaway is, wait, if Laura's turning into a werewolf, how and when did that happen? What's going on with that? This totally disrupts the movie. It had me up until the moment Laura became a werewolf.
Yeah, the problems with this film exist long before that's the case, folks.
Exactly. It's like people who criticize Ben Affleck for ruining Daredevil. And it's like, yep, cast anybody else in that role, this film would be a brilliant. Yeah, so that takes us to the end of the film. And on, I think I also just need to pause and take a breath because this film, it's not that the narrative has twists and turns as much as Again, this film seems to be three different films at the same time. That's kind of oddly interspersed with itself. A lot happens. Having a, final 20 minutes that comes from a completely different film universe doesn't help. But what I can say is that this film was not what I was expecting it to be, nor did any scene that followed, go according to the expectations I had for it.
Well, this is the thing. Let me be clear here. This film will not bore you while you're watching it. I mean, that's one thing for sure. I mean, it is, if nothing else, it's watchable. And there is interesting stuff going on in it, but you feel like you could you see where, with a little refinement, with a few rewrites and a little more focus and a director who can shoot special effects material, this could actually be a really solid film here overall. And
Like, it certainly has potential, and you're right. Like, for the most part, it is competently made. You would expect a film that cost $70 million in 1994 to be competently made. But yeah, like, it's a film that's weirdly at odds with itself.
well, and that's just the thing, because I mean, whenever, like, I mean, the idea of a werewolf film set within the publishing world, that's a fun concept. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that would be obvious at first. And again, I give credit to the film for having sort of a novel way into it, but it just
Or you could almost see like a 1970s version of this movie where it's more like a romantic comedy, and the hook is just that one guy's becoming a wolf man. You can also see like maybe later in the decade, you could even argue that American Psycho kind of is this, where it's really leaning into the horror elements and really concretely tying corporatism to a sort of cannibalism.
Well, there is definitely, yeah, like the predatory aspect of corporate America and what it does. And I mean, and that's the thing, like there are ideas there, but like the thing with the corporate takeover, thematically you can read into it, but it's not developed as an idea in this film. Like, I'm still not sure whether we're supposed to take away whether this sort of predatory nature of how business is run is supposed to be a good or bad thing in this movie. Like, it's
Well,
not
yeah,
clear.
because it's what leads to Will's professional redemption, at least until he turns into a wolf and runs away. But yeah, like it's very much framed as a positive, but even his descent onto playing dirty isn't really all that negative as much as him taking back his job from a guy who screwed him over and slept with his wife, as opposed to him being corrupted by power or anything like that. So it's weirdly inert. And I think the only way that that makes sense is because really, whatever this film has to say about, the changing workforce and corporate organization of 80s business is completely beside the point.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, really, the through line of this film is, I mean, basically, masculinity, really more than anything else, and the particular type of masculinity between, older individuals and younger individuals. And that's really what the film ultimately comes down to. And this is where, I mean, the film is ultimately a middle-aged man's power fantasy at the end of the day, which, I mean, I'm not saying that's inherently a bad thing. It's just, it's an obvious thing about this movie here. Like, this is really is, like, it really precedes the sort of, old men still got it films that we see in the form of things like The Expendables or other similar, old people can still, do things, this instance. I mean, Nicholson's, I mean, he's not old yet, but he's very much like that mid to late 50s, if not 60s, phase of his career, where it's like, yeah, you've been a star for years at this point. And I would say, I mean, Terms of Endearment is probably the first one where I'd say he really starts recognizing his age issue from the earlier in the prior decade. But this is definitely an evolution of that, and what we'll see continue on with things like As Good as It Gets and ultimately About Schmidt being probably the ultimate final example of him sort of coping with that idea of his aging as a man, as it were.
Yeah.
And
And I mean, again, those films are tied by defying urination, but they do kind of form the bookend of the beginning and full acceptance of the fact that Jack Nicholson, well, he is living forever, but he's not living forever young.
Well, exactly. And I mean, it's very noticeable, yeah, when you think about it, the fact that Nicholson did choose to retire. He hasn't chosen to work up until the day he died, like some actors would. Like, I mean, I honestly, it almost feels like he was getting it out of his system. So I think in terms of this film's placement in his filmography and what it means to his overall career, this one is fascinating and well worth checking out for those purposes. And again, I can't say that I'm not recommending it in the sense that this is a straight up bad movie. It's not the film you're hoping it's going to be. It's not the film that it could be. It's a deeply flawed film that has its high points and some incredibly dour low points throughout its runtime.
Yeah, it's as Lawrence Gowan once said, it's a strange animal. I don't know if you've got to follow. It's a very curious snapshot though of an actor in transition and an industry in transition as well. It's neither scary nor action exciting. It's not really funny. Again, it hits that sort of liminal James L. Brooks sort of territory where it's just kind of its own thing and a style of movie that doesn't really seem there anymore. But it's also an instance of directors coming to horror rather than them pulling horror into their mode, I guess. That being said, I'm out of things to say beyond the recap. And I think on that note, all the better we turn to our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits. So Dave, 1994, Mike Nichols' Wolf. There are a lot of things to like. We got a big cast. We got a competent crew. What is your first hit for Wolf?
First of all, I gotta say, you didn't go with Moonlight Desires as the go-end song to choose in this instance. But in this instance, I'm gonna give it to James Spader because I love what a weaselly little brat he is. And so, I mean.
Yeah, as bad as the climax is, he is absolutely committed to his role.
Exactly. And that's the thing about Spader. It's like, I always feel like he was popular, but he was never a megastar. But I don't think I've ever seen him give a bad performance in a movie. And this is right in that time where, he had that phase where he was very much the guy to, well, if it's sort of a sexually charged thriller or film of some sort, we are going to, you cast James Spader. You've got things like Dreamlover. You've got things like Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Like, there's a ton of things where it's just like that was James Spader's mode for most of the 90s. And this film taps
Except
into
for
it.
also in 1994 when he was the nerdy guy in Stargate.
That
But
was.
that's very much a non-James Spader kind of role.
Well, he's perfect in the role, but it's just like, yep, the one time James Spader was going to be in a blockbuster prior to Age of Ultron, this is where he went. So, yeah, I mean, James Spader, I mean, I'm always happy to see him. He's a really likable presence on screen. And, I mean, here, yeah, the final act of the movie does him no favors, but it doesn't do any of the cast any favors here. So, I mean, he makes the most of it and at least is having a ball playing this character and going up against, I mean, again, going toe to toe with Nicholson and Pfeiffer. I mean, it's not like he's, he brings his A game to this movie. So I salute him for his work here. What about you, Andrew? What would you go with for your first hit?
Oh man, there are some good options. I am probably going to give it to a friend of the show and repeat offender, my boy, composer Ennio Morricone, because again, Morricone has a very interesting style as a composer where there is something that's both very classical and yet, I don't want to be, it's classical meets modern, but there is something very contemporary about his sensibilities. And again, describing this film himself as a man stuck in a dream, I think the score actually does really make it work better than it ought to at times, because you got the strings there, you got sort of the romantic scenes that are really punctuated by what feels like a very classical score. Even again, the transformation scenes does seem like a callback, but it also works very well set against the backdrop of the New York publishing industry. So I would say, because there's no point where the score made me laugh out loud, unlike most other things about this movie, I'm gonna give it to my boy Ennio. What about you, Dave, for your second hit?
Jim Dolz, the production designer on this film, because I mean, I still can't determine whether the publishing house is a set or whether it's a building that they just shot in. Either way, though,
Yeah, I think it's the sound stage, but it is really impressively laid out.
and that's the thing, like the it's a multi-tier area that they're in where you're able to look down or look up there throughout it. And I will say, Mike Nichols shoots the hell out of that set because it's got this beautiful, ornate design to it. Like, it looks like the interior of a building that was probably built in the 30s or 40s, with that sort of real sort of Art Deco aesthetic to it. And again, you get the sense it's like, yeah, this is a high-end publishing firm in New York City. Like, it really is evocative of that. And I can, and again, just the way people move about the space, the even just like the interior of Will's office when you're in it, where it's not massive, but there's so much detail and life that's been brought into it. Like, it is a fantastic job there. And you know, that's not to say that the other sets in the film are not as good, but I mean, they are quite good. But the Alden's estate is pretty standard fare. Same with the sort of interior apartments. They're good. I mean, they're very well done, but really that central set for mo where a good chunk of the film is set is fantastic. And if that is well worth seeing, particularly if you can watch this thing in HD, because just soak in all that detail and design there, folks. It's magnificent there. What about you though, Andrew? What would be your fourth or your second and final hit for this one?
I mean, there's a lot of good little performances. Michelle Pfeiffer is good, but I feel like the character is fairly underdeveloped. Like, it sort of it keeps Laura at the tier where, because a lot of her is a mystery, it's like, well, it turns out that I can pick the lock on handcuffs. I picked this up during my wild years. So at the risk of being a bad male feminist, I'm gonna give it to Christopher Plummer, only because we know Jack Nicholson. Even though he can sometimes be self-parodic, is a capable actor. I would give it to Plummer because A, I love Christopher Plummer. B, he's a very good actor, especially playing stern old men. And C, when's the last time you've seen Nicholson play against anybody, especially as he got older, where they are an older man in a position of superiority over them? But I also like his approach to Raymond, where there's almost that sense of, even when he's doing remarkably cruel things to you, he's shaking your hand and looking you in the eye and just hopes you'll understand that this is the way it has to be. But also, I mean, the way it gives way to that sort of, not even begrudging respect by the end of Will making his play. Like, it is a satisfying payoff. That scene in the boardroom is also well done. And any scene that Nicholson and Plummer are on screen together, like, you realize that Nicholson's talented, but there are some actors that are very easily on his level. And I mean, so you end up having a whole bunch of scenes where two very good actors who are still very much near the top of their games get to share the screen together, and it's nice watching pros work together.
Absolutely. And I would say the difference is, I mean, Nicholson by this stage of his career, he is a good actor, but he's also got a very set persona. Whereas Christopher Plummer, you could just let that man rip in just about anything and he will just
Yeah.
do
It's like
it.
3 years later we get As Good as It Gets, and even though Nicholson wins the Oscar, like that film is him just being his public persona.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, yeah, no, I completely agree with you, but this does bring us to the pits, however. And I know there's a number of things we've sort of hit this film for, but what would you say is your first pit for this particular film here, Andrew?
Where to even begin? I think for all of the successes in using it subtly, I think Rick Baker's makeup really doesn't actually come out all that well, especially in the last part of the film, where I think like Everybody does their full transformation. You would think that would look most impressive. 1994, though, is still a sizably long time ago. It does not look very impressive. And maybe it's compounded by the fact that the film is just bonkers at that point and the editing is fairly poor in that sequence, but like, that's the point where you're looking at very clear and obvious prosthetics. And again, that just pulls me right out of the film. And it's a shame because the earlier transformation sequences, as we noted, really do rely on less is more. And it's just, okay, put a bit of extra hair on Jack Nicholson and some fangs. You know, that seems to work a lot better than when they fully lean into it. And maybe it's just a product of its time or something like that, but yeah, I found it weirdly unimpressive as the film went on.
Well, and this sort of brings me to my first pit for this one, which I have to give it to director Mike Nichols. And look, I mean, there's a lot that he does right in this movie. This is not a, straight up, you don't know what your job is, but there's a point where he should have recognized that either he was in over his head in terms of certain aspects of this movie, or that he really needed somebody to either help him, realize how are we going to storyboard? How are we going to stage? How are we going to work with this? Because I think the thing about Rick Baker's makeup is it's really good, but he just, like, at a certain point, Nichols just doesn't know how to light it. He doesn't know how to shoot it. And again, like, come back to the animatronic werewolves, or wolves at the start of the film. I mean, that's the kind of scene where either one of two things have happened. Either he thinks he's paying tribute to old school visual effects by doing it and by having it be the obvious puppet, which, number one, they weren't trying to be obvious in those old movies, Nichols. Okay, that was just the limitations of the time, there. So you're sort of sabotaging yourself for reasons you don't know, or, and what I think is probably more far likely, he just really doesn't know how to work with those kinds of things. And I think it's very telling when you look at the bulk of the movies he made afterwards, he never really tried to do anything this effects heavy ever again in his career. And that's the sort of thing where I come back to, people might knock schlocky genre filmmakers from time to time for being, well, they're not really making high art. Yeah, but there's still a skill and craft in what they do. And if you don't have those components of the job down, it will show, and by God, does it show here. So, Nichols, respect the living hell out of you. May you rest in peace, but you got to be my first hit or pit in this instance here. What about you, Andrew? What would be your second pit?
I mean, I think on the technical side, I'm probably going to go with Sam Osteen again, only because I think, regardless of a director's unfamiliarity working with certain material, having a good or at least competent editor, like, it's one thing not to be comfortable shooting an epic action sequence, but I feel like when you're the film's editor, you should at least always have a basic sense of rhythm and flow to the proceedings. And by the time we get to the third act, which again, you can't really blame on Jim Harrison, at least if he's to be believed, and looking at his body of work, doesn't seem likely. And I mean, you could put it on Strick, but you know, the film does a number of clever things as well, and depending on who you believe, none of the screenwriters wanted the ending as it was anyway. In spite of all of that, though, a good editor can tie things together, keep it moving, or at least know what shots not to use, and I just don't think that was the case with Osteen here.
And this is where I want to know how much of that's Osteen, or whether it's just Osteen getting the footage back from Nichols and looking at it and realizing it's like, I am missing so many things. I need to make this work. And that's where I feel like I don't know where to place the blame. I agree that Osteen's editing, definitely by the third act for sure, is frustrated here. And given the how closely him and Nichols work together, yeah, it's hard not to blame one without the other. I would say for my final pit here, there's just simply not enough Eileen Atkins or David Hyde Pierce in this movie. Like,
they're a lot of fun.
Yeah, like, I mean, they're very brief, but I could watch the hell out of them, you know, palling around as Jack Nicholson's, you know, support network for much more of this movie. I mean, David Hyde Pierce, like, I feel bad because he's one of those actors who I don't think a lot of people recognize just how good it is. He is at what he does. Like, there is a skill and slyness to his comedic charm and performances here, and Atkins just knows exactly how to play off of him and then how to play off of Nicholson, and she is just a delight in this movie. And again, I mean, it's again a shame that, you know, they just didn't simply get more to do, but I, given the nature of this movie, I also admit it's kind of hard to see where you would fit more of them in.
And the film already does enough, maybe even too much, to really know what it's handling. I don't think adding a C plot about, you know, the ongoing day to day of the support staff would make this film any more linear.
No.
But, you know, there's something to be said for small doses. And I mean, Atkins is good in a limited role. Pierce is fun. On Puri is actually really good in the one scene that he's in.
Yeah.
Richard Jenkins, reliable standby there. Again, I mean, maybe that's this film in a nutshell. Less is so much more, and the film is so much more when it's doing less. And all you need to know to prove that is to rewatch the last 15 minutes when it goes for broke and becomes an entirely different movie.
Well, exactly. And on that note, I would say that is Wolf. Occasionally it's popped up on the Criterion Channel. Probably solely because Mike Nichols directed this. I don't imagine there's any other reason why this would be there, but, yeah, I mean, certainly that's one way to check it out. Otherwise, I didn't really look into it, but I imagine the DVDs are still probably available for this thing. So watch and enjoy if you so choose, but I also don't blame you if you say, nah, this is going to be a pass.
Yeah. Well, speaking of passing, though, we are going to pass down this here highway and hopefully avoid the local lupine population as we think onwards and upwards to the next movie that we're going to be looking at. So, Dave, why don't you tell the good people at home what we'll be checking out next week and how we are going to get there?
Well, we all enjoyed Christopher Plummer this week, and so he's going to be joining. Well, let's put him in for the third or fourth time he's on. Because he was...
Let's see. All the Money in the World.
Yep. Wolf. Was he on another film? Maybe he wasn't. I'll have to go back through and double check this. But the point is, we're following him to Spike Lee's 2006 film, Inside Man. So yes, we're returning to the world of Spike Lee after visiting him last time with Old Boy, quite some ways back. Yeah.
And more importantly, we're looking at Spike Lee for the modern phase of his career, where... if you're anything like me, you walked in 7 minutes late without knowing what the film was about and absolutely shocked at the end. That was a Spike Lee movie?
Well, and on top of which, this, if I'm not mistaken, this is the first time in over nearly 170 episodes that we're taking a look at Denzel Washington.
And I'm pretty sure it's the first time ever that we've looked at Clive Owen.
This might actually be the first time we've looked at Clive Owen, which is...
Old Jug Ears himself. So it's bound to be a fun one.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't seen that film in a while. I believe it can still be categorized as a taut psychological thriller, but... It'll be fun to go back, and even if it's not, well, we get another good performance from Christopher Plummer. So, until that episode drops, Dave, where can people get in touch with you?
Well, you can find me at 24Panels. I'm always happy to have a civil conversation. What about you, Andrew?
You can find me on Twitter at FilmStripper, or by emailing the show at FilmStripsPodcast@gmail.com. HelloFresh, I am not interested in your meal baskets, but what we are interested in is people's feedback. So rate and review us, iTunes or whatever service you use. It's nice to give us a good review. 5 stars help move us up the feature chart, but more importantly, it's where you can let us know, how's it going? What do you love about us? What do you hate about us? Because if you tell us what you hate, we're going to fix it. Because all David and I have ever wanted to do is bring you the kind of show that you want to listen to.
Indeed. So with that, are there any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with, Andrew?
Why, yes, David, there are. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
If you're lucky, you'll at least film your death in a competent way. Bye.